Track 13. Next, we bring you the Past Lives feature, looking at the people who made our county great. First, Great Scott. Chris Armstrong investigates the life of the man who coined the word Poppyland.
Those of us lucky enough to live in Norfolk honour and curse Clement Scott in roughly equal measure. We're grateful to him for his advocacy of the merits of the area, which helped resorts such as Cromer and Overstrand develop into Edwardian gems. But sometimes, those of us who are not dependent on the money spent here by tourists may regret in the summer season that he did it quite so well. Ironically, Scott may himself have been in two minds. He coined the word Poppyland to encapsulate the quiet and peaceful beauty of the area, but later in life he must have felt some twinges of regret at the success of his efforts, because he coined a second descriptive noun for it, bungalow land. Either way, to us, Scott is almost synonymous with the late Victorian Edwardian vision of an unspoilt coastal district where life was slow, simple, and straightforward, and where, in the days before fertilizers and chemical weed killers, the pre-harvest fields were liberally speckled with the red of poppies, sadly now seen only in hedgerows or where the farmer's spray has missed its aim. But our vision is incomplete. Scott was far more than a rather lyrical, country-loving poet with a deep affection for North Norfolk. Indeed, his entry in the Oxford National Dictionary of Biography doesn't mention Norfolk at all, and barely mentions Poppyland. His was a life of precipitous ups and downs. His championship of Norfolk began during a prolonged up. His first visit to Poppyland resulted in an article published in the Daily Telegraph in August 1883. Scott had visited Cromer at the instigation of the Great Eastern Railway Company, and the article was their reward. The extension of the line to Cromer had been completed in 1877, and the company was anxious to demonstrate the attractions of the area to the better class of visitors. They could hardly have chosen a better or more influential advocate. Educated at Marlborough, on leaving school, Scott became a junior civil servant working at the War Office, a role he later combined with a spell as theatre critic on the Sunday Times, which he became at the age of 22. This was a brief appointment. Theatre critics are not a breed renowned for their sensitive handling of the egos of others, but Scott was unusually acerbic and intemperate in some of his criticisms. He could be highly critical, not just of some of the productions, but also of the theatre managers, and in particular, London audiences, who had enjoyed, or suffered, depending on your viewpoint, a reputation for boisterous and disruptive behaviour, dating back centuries. While some actors were delighted at his admonition of noisy audiences, his biting criticism of theatre and actor managers drove them to complain at his behaviour to such a degree that his contract was terminated after just 2 years. To have been given such an appointment at an early age suggests a combination of connection and competence. The connection was a fellow War Office clerk, Tom Hood. Hood's father was a poet noted for his humorous rhymes, and Tom wrote in a similar vein. Although they joined the War Office at the same time, Hood was a few years older than Scott, having been up to Oxford before joining the civil service. At Oxford, he'd already established a reputation for humorous writing and had even edited a local newspaper. Throughout his 5 years at the War Office, he continued to write prolifically and clearly recognised similar wit and talent in Scott and took him under his wing. He not only encouraged him to write, but introduced him to the editor of The Era, a magazine which focused on the stage, and Scott began to write for it. But he was even more helpful in the same year, 1865, that Scott lost his role with the Sunday Times. Hood became editor of Fun Magazine, a rather more biting and satirical competitor to Punch. This was a weekly paper specialising in stories of the theatre and of travel. One of its principal writers was W.S. Gilbert, so when Hood invited Scott to write for the paper, he found himself in distinguished, if somewhat bohemian, company. They were a group who sparked off one another, sharing with Punch the idea of a round table in a cafe where, meeting as a convivial group, ideas could emerge and rumours be shared. Fun, with a particular emphasis on the theatre, and a lively style, suited both Scott's interests and his wit. It was perhaps through this medium that he first met some of the distinguished theatricals, Ellen Terry and Irving amongst them, who were later to follow his footsteps to Poppyland. Scott's talents were noticed. In 1871, he joined the Daily Telegraph, writing about travel as well as the theatre. It was the beginning of a long relationship. He took over as drama critic in 1878, a post he held for nearly 20 years. It seemed secure enough for him finally to resign from the War Office in 1879 to devote himself full-time to writing. By then he was established in the public eye and had developed a close relationship with some of the most eminent actors and managers. Henry Irving was a particular friend and the founder of another magazine, The Theatre, which he invited Scott to edit and to whom he later sold the title. Scott didn't just review plays, he wrote a number as well, but it is particularly as a reviewer that he is remembered, partly because his approach was original. His comments could greatly influence the success or failure of a new production. In an entirely novel approach, he insisted that reviews were always to be written immediately after the first performance of a new play. Now, traditionally, reviewers had allowed producers a few days' grace to iron out any wrinkles, but he was adamant that a paying audience should enjoy the finished article even on the first night. His influence grew immensely, and he was widely consulted. Amongst those whom he advised were Oscar Wilde at one end of the spectrum and those responsible for the censorship of plays at the other. It was in this period when his popularity was at its highest and his writings were widely read that he came to Poppyland. Not initially over-impressed with Cromer, he walked into the country around it, coming to Overstrand and Sidestrand, where he took a room in the house of the miller and met the miller's daughter, Louis Jermy, whose innocence, fresh country charm, and anxiety to broaden her own education appealed to him greatly and brought him back time and again. The word Poppyland first appeared in a poem written by Scott, which was included in his 1886 Poppyland Papers. The name immediately caught on and is still familiar today. The word was a gift for the publicist. Railway posters, china cups and knick-knacks of all sorts, even a Poppyland perfume, rapidly appeared. The railway was extended to Overstrand, and the rich and famous, not just theatrical ones, flocked to the area, which became the fashionable place to spend the summer. Scott's memorial in Cromer bears the inscription, "Who by his pen immortalised Poppyland?" And so indeed he did. Sadly, Scott's reputation later took a dramatic fall. Strangely, for the son of an Anglican priest who converted to Catholicism before the age of 21, it was an article he wrote for a small evangelical magazine that lay behind the problem. Writing for an audience he anticipated would agree with him, he wrote a very intemperate piece about the acting profession, quite specifically asserting that "it is really impossible for a woman to remain pure who adopts the stage as a profession." Unfortunately, the piece, intended for the small audience, comprising the readership of Great Thoughts magazine, was leaked and in general circulation before the magazine had even been printed. Not unnaturally, his theatrical associates were outraged, and even Scott came to realise he'd gone too far and was profuse in his apologies. Too late, he was barred from some theatres and sacked by the Daily Telegraph. He moved to France and visited the United States, where another acerbic piece in the New York Herald in 1899 was not well received in England. His health deteriorated, and his income too. Relatively impoverished on his return to England, his former friends rallied round and held a benefit for him in 1904. But sadly, he died within a few days of the event. The man we remember with affection as the promoter of North Norfolk was a man of great influence and guilty of occasional lapses of judgment, which cost him dear. But he was also a revolutionary influence in the art of criticism and a writer of considerable wit.